But we have heard quite a bit recently about the battle we're facing in this world and the position that we should be taking. To see the world for what it is and the forces that are at work and the things that are happening to destroy mankind and those who pursue the kingdom of God. We heard from John Duncan a couple weeks ago about waxing cold and the need to stabilize our perspective and keep that love alive. From our pastor last week, we heard about the need to be strong in faith, seeing the enemy and being prepared for the battle of faith that we shall face in the coming days. I'd like to continue down that same path with a slightly different perspective on Matthew 24:12. Because there are wars, spiritual deceptions, lawlessness, famines, pestilences, earthquakes, you and I may be delivered up to tribulation, and indeed we will be hated by all nations for his name's sake. The backdrop to this is our lives today. I think we can all agree. To see the circumstances, the deception, and the battle we must wage, it looks a little deeper. Let's look a little deeper into this topic today and see what we can discover. Nancy was a charge nurse in San Francisco General in 1950. Nancy loved to tell the story of why she became a nurse. It was her grandmother. She used to go as a teenager to the hospital as a candy striper. She got to do things with grandmother, and she knew grandma was a gentle soul. She was a charge nurse, so she was decisive and yet tough. But the compassion that her grandmother showed and that interaction with patients inspired young Nancy to follow in her footsteps. Fast forward 20 years, Nancy's been doing what she's dreamed, working at San Francisco General as a charge nurse on the trauma ward. For 15 years now, she has done what she had dreamed of doing, becoming like her grandmother. But something was changing. Something different was happening to Nancy, and she wasn't sure, but her co-worker started noticing that she was becoming a little curt, a little short, not the same gentle soul that she had been for some 15 years now. In fact, the backdrop, she had won the award for the most compassionate nurse 3 times. But something was different. Nancy's family started noticing she was changing. Something different was happening to her. A little more curt with the kids. A little bit more withdrawn from interacting with the family. Not wanting to go places. Not wanting to do things. Nancy realized what was happening. Something wasn't right. She knew it wasn't right and didn't know what it was. After things progressively got worse, she finally got with one of her closest friends and sat down. And over the next several hours, through tears and conversation, Nancy explained what was happening. Her friend just listened to what was going on. And after about 2 hours, she concluded, "Nancy, I think you need to get help. I think you should see a doctor." 3 weeks later, she finally got an appointment set and went to see the hospital psychiatrist, more likely back then, and started to present her case to the doctor. It was 3 sessions in counseling when the doctor started to say, "I think I know what it is, but let me read back to you the symptoms that you're facing so that you can hear what I've noted." He says the patient shows signs of a lack of interest in things that she enjoyed previously. She's experiencing persistent images and thoughts about people she had been connected to for so long. Feelings of an emotional numbing of her senses. A desire to withdraw from her family and friends. Experiencing nightmares, insomnia, and intermittent wake-ups between sleep. irritation with little provocation, and outbursts of anger. A sense of disillusionment, worthlessness, hopelessness, and resentment with work. She showed signs of a lack of self-confidence and a loss of her optimism. Signs of negative energy and the fear of being unsuccessful in her career, even as a wife and a mother. Nancy's response was devastation when she heard everything the doctor had just repeated to her. The doctor began to say, "What might be happening," Nancy sat up, looked closely, wanting a conclusion to the matter and figuring out what it is. The doctor said, "Nancy, I think you have compassion fatigue." "Compassion fatigue? What do you mean? I'm tired of being compassionate?" "Well, yes," the doctor said, "it's a little bit oversimplified, but yes. So you are tired from showing compassion to people over an extended period of time. Your tank is becoming empty." Nancy was devastated and told the doctor, what can I do? How do we address this?" And then she sat in silence. When we hear about this, what's affecting Nancy, it starts to chip away at we call that term, how we can become cold. Even if it's completely unintentional, this process that Nancy was going through is similar to what we can face as humans in the human condition that can help push us down the path of waxing cold. So what is compassion fatigue and how can it impact us? Webster's defines compassion fatigue as the inability to react sympathetically to a crisis, disaster, because overexposure to previous crises and disasters. The medical terminology says it this way: compassion fatigue is a psychological disorder associated with gradual lessening of compassion over time. The medical terminology for this syndrome is called secondary traumatic stress disorder. Seeing Nancy's condition and how it very well may happen to us, when we speak of the love waxing cold, or compassion fatigue, if you will, we know this is a spiritual condition, and we understand that the battle is not physical. It's a spiritual battle. It's what's happening inside our cognitive battleground. Paul reminds us, and we have heard quite a bit recently about this, that the battle is spiritual, not physical. In 2 Corinthians, I'll turn over to 2 Corinthians, chapter 10, and verse 6, and we're just reminded that we walk in the flesh. "Though we walk in the flesh, we do not war against the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but are mighty in God, in the pulling down of strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity into the obedience of Christ." We've heard a lot about that recently, where our objective is to bring every thought into captivity and subject it to the laws of God, subject it to the statutes and the testimony of Christ, and to be like Christ, to submit ourselves to Him. We have an example here of Christ showing compassion in Matthew chapter 9. In Matthew chapter 9, this is where Christ was looking over Jerusalem and seeing the multitudes. In verse 36, he says, "But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no..." Okay, I'm going to keep going no matter what you say there, iPhone. He was moved with compassion for them because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. It's interesting, when you look at the word for compassion in this one, it's a deep groaning from the bowels. It moves you. It's felt deep inside you. In another verse, it says Jesus wept. He was moved with compassion for those he saw, And he's able to relate to us and the suffering and the experiences that we face in the world. And there is that requirement that we're required to become like him in this way. To become the sons and daughters of God. That said, the onus is on each of us to fight this battle. But what is the battle? Who is the enemy? How do we fight? How do we prevent compassion fatigue? We can look in 1 Peter 5:8 to see who the enemy is. In 1 Peter 5:8, very simple, well-known scripture, in verse 8 of 1 Peter 5, he says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, your enemy, is the devil. And he walks about like a roaring lion, seeking who he may devour." Very easy to see who the enemy is and what his objectives are. Another verse we can turn to is Daniel 7, which puts us more in context with the end time that we're living in now. In Daniel 7, in verse 21, in the first part of 22, Daniel's seeing the vision of the four beasts and the ten horns representing the resurrected Roman empires and the other kingdoms prior to that. He's saying, "I'm watching as this tenth horn, this tenth kingdom, is attacking, and the beast power is attacking." And he said, "As I was watching that same horn making war against the saints and prevailing against them." In the beginning of verse 22, he says, "But until the Ancient of Days came." It's interesting that we see, as time goes on, as we get closer and closer to the end, the warfare that we're facing is going to intensify to the point where Satan is going to be prevailing over us. He didn't say conquer, he didn't say destroy us, but he said he would be prevailing over us. Otherwise, we're going to have some trials. And sometimes we're going to win, sometimes we're not going to win. But when we look at this, we want to focus our eyes to see what it is that we can do to resist what Satan is attempting to do to us. In Matthew 6, beginning in verse 23, Christ tells us something. Tells us something about perspective. Tells us something to set our sights on to keep focus. In Matthew 6, beginning in verse 21, he says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The lamp of the body is the eye. Therefore, if your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" Where your treasure is, what is your perspective, objective, goal? What's the end game that we're trying to reach? And what do you set your mind to accomplish? If it is on the right target, the ability to see, because you're focusing and pursuing that, is easier to see. If you decide not to see it, you decide not to do it, then you can be filled with darkness. Because if you're not pursuing light, something's filling the void. I was reading a book recently. I've read it several times over the years. It's called The Art of War by Sun Tzu. Don't normally read warfare books, but looking at this topic, it's one of those that we have a battle, we have an enemy, we're at war. So let's look at what maybe the enemy might say about war and how they attack. In The Art of War, Sun Tzu gives 11 battle tactics. And it's interesting to read through those. But before I go there, there's two things that he mentions that you have to know when you go into war and you start to fight the battle. He said, if you know the enemy and you know yourself, you need not fear 100 battles. If you know yourself but not know your enemy, for every victory you gain, you'll suffer a loss. If you know the enemy but not yourself, the same result. A victory you gain, you will have a loss. But if you don't know the enemy and you don't know yourself, you will certainly be destroyed. Something that we should consider, coming from a military mind it's been very highly regarded by quite a few people in the military over many, many years. The book was actually written recently, but it was actually transcribed from writings 500 BC. So it's quite an old book at the end of the day. The 11 tactics that Sun Tzu points out, unnerving when you hear them, but when we look, we put this in the context of how Satan attacks us, each one of us, every day, 24/7, 365, no relenting. Sun Tzu points out these 11 things. As the attacker, he says, when we are able to attack, we must seem unable. When we are using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make our enemy believe we are far away. And when we are far away, we must make our enemy think we are near. We hold out baits to entice the enemy, to feign disorder, and then to crush him. If he is secure on all points, that is, looking at us, if we're secure, he said, they must prepare more. If he is superior in force, he says we must evade him. If your opponent is hot-tempered, seek to irritate him. Pretend to be weak, that he may grow arrogant. I like that one. That's interesting. If he's taking ease, give him no rest. If his forces are united, separate him. Attack him where he is unprepared, appear where you are not, where he is not expected. These 11 tactics are what we experience day in and day out. So many people in several of these things, I can think of Job and several other instances where the attack is so consistent, so unrelenting. I mean, Job never had a moment of rest through his trial. And you see, the inspiration that Sun Tzu had was never give him ease. Keep him constantly in toil. To break him, to destroy him, which is the desire that Satan has for each one of us. Other parts, and the one that sticks out that I like the most is when he said, if he is superior in force, evade him. That wonderful scripture that we can turn over to that says, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. The battle tactics are known. The scripture encodes all of this information that Sun Tzu is talking about as our defense posture, as well as an offensive posture we can take against it. When you see the battlefield for your minds, the value system, the internal doctrine you use every day to evaluate and dissimulate what you will do to face these constant attacks and still maintain love that is full of compassion, even for your enemy. We heard earlier that we're to pray for our enemies. And that can become pretty challenging when you start facing these type of attacks, the relentless, unceasing attacks. What is the battle? What's happening? What are they doing? How is Satan attacking? It's the friction everywhere. It's the push of agendas everywhere. We hear of simple things like climate change in the news. They want to kill all the cattle because they pass gas, which is going to destroy the ozone. The LGBT movement, the gender identity movement, the teaching of children under 10 years old how to have sex with men and women. Under 10, it's curriculum. We heard a little bit last week about the conversion therapy bans, where in Madrid, Malta, 20 U.S. states, that they're trying to ban people who have become gay and no longer want to be gay, the shock therapies and all that they've done 40 years ago. But what they're trying to encode into the law is that even a pastor who has been requested by a member of their church who says, I don't want to be this way anymore, can you help me? They want to make it against the law through this statute that pastor cannot do that. He can go to jail for doing it. And these level of all these things that are playing out, this battle that's happening, where Satan's putting all these roots in all these different areas, trying to make it to be a Christian is going to become extremely hard. Extremely hard. And what we're facing in the future is quite challenging. If you look at movies, TV, if you're a news junkie, I pray for you. Because the news that you read today becomes so absurd, the behavior that people do, and the response and the agenda of everything that's happening, it's just it makes you just want to turn the TV off and say, these people are all crazy. And they indeed probably are, but we can't completely do that. But when you hear all these things happening, you start to see where love starts to wax cold. Because you want to turn it off. You want the pain and the suffering and the absurdities to go away. You don't want any more input. Like Nancy was suffering from constantly working with people that were in sickness and health, cancer, and people dying. She couldn't take it. Her system was starting to reject her ability to have compassion because it just couldn't take any more. Likewise, we're faced with that exact same thing in the world we live in. And as time goes on, it continually gets worse and worse. I heard one thing just the other day. It was a little bit alarming, where the military was going to be forced to do gender changes at the price of $250,000 to change. It's going to be required that if somebody chooses that they want to be different, that the government is responsible to make them what they want to be. We live in a society where if people want to be something they think, though they're not, we're going to allow that. What does that mean? Where are we going with that? So we start to see the absurdity of everything that Satan is doing and his attacks to break our society down to where it does it. We don't even want to be around here anymore. We don't enjoy society. We don't enjoy life anymore when it gets so absurd. And that's exactly what he's trying to do through his tactics, to break each and every one of us down to the point where we don't want to do this anymore. We don't want to love our enemies. We just don't want to be anywhere near anybody because of the level of intensity that it's becoming. So I have to ask the question, do you and I have symptoms of compassion fatigue today? Do you show any signs or lack of interest in things that you've enjoyed previously? Do you experience persistent images and thoughts about people you were once connected to for so long? Do you have any feelings of an emotional numbing of your senses? Do you have any desire to withdraw from friends and family members? Are you experiencing nightmares, insomnia, intermittent wake-ups between your sleep? Are you agitated or have irritation with little provocation, even outbursts of anger? Do you have a sense of disillusionment? Worthlessness, hopelessness, resentment at work, home, or at church? Are you lacking in self-control, self-confidence, and a loss of an optimistic outlook? Do you have any signs of negative energy and fear of becoming unsuccessful in your career, in your relationships, at home, church, family? When we ask these questions, they spell out the symptoms of compassion fatigue and or what we would state, your love is waxing cold. If you're being worn down, we must see the battle that is breaking us down and find the rest, the rejuvenation, and the support to gain strength again. So what happened to Nancy? What did she do? She did find relief. She did reignite her passion for caregiving. Her and many others since the 1950s. See, in the 1950s, many of these hospitals had to take steps because they didn't know what was happening to Nancy. They didn't know what compassion fatigue was. It was a new thing that was coming on because of the amount of work that the nurses had to do. But Nancy was fortunate. The problem was still being diagnosed, but the help she got from the doctor, getting a balance back into her life, the story ends happy for her and her family. And the trials that she faced, the story comes to a happy conclusion. Nancy's happily now serving at the hospital, helping other nurses with compassion fatigue. I read also that Mother Teresa submitted a plan to her superiors, and this is a number of years ago, but she said that she requested a mandate to her superiors that would give every nun serving 4 to 5 years 1 year off. Otherwise, showing compassion to those who are caregivers to give them a rest, a take away and get recharged. We're no different, I don't think, than nurses as Christians finding this balance in our lives. But what else can we do? So what were some of the things that Nancy did? What was the advice that she was given to help her recover? The prescription was this. First, there's 7 steps. Finding a balance is the first one in your professional and personal life, and taking time off if you can. These are pretty simple responses, surprisingly. The second thing, following self-care routines, prayer, meditation, get enough sleep, choose healthy food, get regular exercise, and nurture your relationships. 3, avoiding information overload and paying attention to how stressful or traumatic information affects you. Number 4, identifying your priorities and engaging in activities that will replenish, rejuvenate you. We know our calling. We have to use the tools given to us through prayer, meditation, and especially fellowship. Number 5, practicing gratitude and being in the present moment. That one can't be understated. Because it's not what could happen, but what am I doing right now? Number 6, understanding the suffering and the pain are part of the collective human experience. And that which you do, not always, let me rephrase that, understanding that the suffering and pain are all part of the collective human experience and that you do not always have control over them. Now we can pray about it and God can answer according to His plan and we can take comfort in that. Many don't have even that option. And then number 7, focusing on areas that you have control over, including your thoughts, feelings, rather than having unrealistic expectations about changing things that may well be out of your control. That's thick and chewy, I know. Focusing on areas that you have control over, including your thoughts and feelings, rather than having unrealistic expectations about changing things that might be beyond your control. Otherwise, you can't change the world. You can't fix what you see on the news. You can't make what is happening in the world under Satan's control. You can't fix that. But you can be present yourself to be who God has called you to be. The friends with our family here can sustain us. In other ways, not possible. The reason for fellowship, the Sabbath, is to ensure that each week we take time to rest from that work, to unplug, turn off the TVs, skip the news, rest, be refreshed, look forward to the fellowship that we enjoy here, to find common-minded people like us, that we can share the life experience of the week, and unload some of the troubles that we may have and have someone that we can reach to console us as well as to offer something back. Each Sabbath we look for that admonition and encouragement and edification that we can get if we participate when we get here. That's how we can be refueled. In Isaiah 49:29, we have a simple statement that's made there. You don't have to turn there, but it simply states, He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, He will increase their strength. Very simple. Go to God. When you need strength, you can get it. Brethren, it's repeated often, but we are in this world for a purpose, to fulfill a calling. It's getting harder and harder as you get closer and closer to the world that's around us. As we see the things unfold, we know the battle is going to become extreme, and we're going to have to fight even more every day. Nancy faced a numbing of her senses. Her mind was trying to disconnect from the constant emotional stress of the disasters, the illnesses, cancer, and death that she faced each and every day for 15 straight years. We too find ourselves facing the societal breakdown, as well as the experiences of life. A lot of the ones that Grant talked about in his message earlier, that we can feel trapped. We can feel like we can't get out. There's no option. Yet there is. We know the enemy. We know the tactics that he's using. The key is to know ourselves and to know what action to take. We are becoming everything that we are called to become, but it requires a tremendous amount of effort to accomplish the task that Christ has given to us. We can't do it. It's not possible. In 2 Thessalonians 3:13, you don't have to turn there, Paul is telling us, "But as for us, brethren, we cannot grow weary in well-doing. The love cannot wax cold. We can't allow the world to kill our compassion." The thought is that we're to pray for our enemies. And that, in a world that really hates us, as time goes on, is going to get harder and harder. And yet, praying for each other is essential. Let's conclude again in Daniel, the 7th chapter, where we hear Daniel's reading through, or Daniel's looking at this battle that's going on. But it has a better last verse in Daniel 7, in verse 21 and 22. I'll read both of them again. "As Daniel was watching the same horn, he was making war against the saints, and he was prevailing, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High. And the time then came for the saints to possess the kingdom." Brethren, if we maintain our compassion, if we do not allow our love to wax cold, if we see how the battle is fought, if we know our enemy and we know ourselves, we have no fear of what's ahead. Yet if we don't know the enemy, but we know ourselves, we lose 50% of the time. If we don't know ourselves but know the enemy, another 50% loss. If we don't take the time to know the enemy and know ourselves and what we're to be doing, and that our eyes are clear and set on the treasure, we can be destroyed completely. And the opportunity, as Grant brought out, for that second death is there, and it exists, and it could be written on our name if we don't follow through on what God has called us to become. We have to maintain our love for this world, regardless of whether it likes us, dislikes us, and in time certainly becomes to hate us. I struggle with the concept of some of the things you see on the news where it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, it just has to be in line with what they want. Even if it's absurd, if you disagree, you are hated. It's not that they don't that you're intolerant. It's just that they hate if you don't agree with them. And as this progressively gets worse, we see the battle becomes much stronger, and that's the one that we're going to face in the very near future. Brethren, we have to maintain this perspective of our treasure so that when we see these people and they hate us, and they hate what we stand for because we don't agree with their way of life, we have to be able to pray for them. I think one of the scriptures that I looked at, I didn't put it in here, was when Christ looked from the cross down at those people who had done everything they had done to him. They sentenced him, they crucified him, they gave him poison, or they gave him vinegar, and they cast lots for his clothing when he's hanging on the cross. And he said, "Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do." A perspective that we have to maintain as we fight this battle against the foe that we have. Brethren, as it says in Daniel 7:20, at the end, verse 22, he said, "And then the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom." Whew. We win.